My mom's all right? I give you a mom report every day. Well, Venerable Ajahn Kuswa and I have been talking about monasteries and creating monasteries and so on. And, one of the things we've been talking about is just the simplicity of some monasteries and the complexity of other monasteries and then the complexity of Western society. And just hearing Stephen ask for the Dhamma talk and contemplating these little rituals that we're involved in, it's a wee taste of one aspect of monastic life. And the aspect is that it's not efficient. You know, like, if you're really efficient, you'd use up all your time, you know, chock-a-block with meaningful things. But there's a lot of space in monastic life where you're just waiting. You're waiting for the meal to start, waiting for the chanting to start, waiting for the talk to start, waiting for the talk to finish. It's a lot of that. And a lot of the kind of that in our Western culture of getting things done and, you know, lists of things to do and accomplishing things, and that whole mindset is very challenged. Very challenged again to do things efficiently. There was one time at Wat Nana Chat there. We had a Wat Nana Chat is a monastery in Thailand, the branch monastery that Ajahn Sumedho started in Thailand. Ajahn Sumedho is an American, for those of you who don't know these people. And we had a small pavilion which we were using as a meditation hall, and we were building a bigger one that we were donated a large Buddha image. And the Buddha image was shipped from Bangkok to the northeast where we were, and it was unloaded at the train station, which was a good 3 kilometers from the monastery. And we had built a concrete plinth for the Buddha image. It was very heavy. It was sort of twice monumental, twice human size, bronze, very heavy. And the Thai lay people were bringing it from the train station to the monastery, and then we Western monks were going to load it onto the plinth. So the Western monks were all very clever, right? Pulley and all this kind of mindset, pulleys and gears and motors and things. And the Thai lay people, well, they got about 40 men and 40 women. The women were cheering the men on. Got a whole bunch of lengths of really heavy bamboo. Just lifted this thing up on their shoulders and walked it the 3 kilometers to the monastery. Great fun, you know, everyone's involved in it. Gets to the monastery, they plunk it down, and the Western monks start having an argument about how to get it on the plinth. And the Thai peasants are just looking at us. They just picked it up and put it on. Ajahn Chah, he said that we Westerners, we have really large houses with a lot of dirty rooms in them. So it takes, you know, we can do a lot of things with these minds, but it takes a lot of cleansing to clean out all these rooms. So just the kind of simplicity of a ritual, I find really, because I'm not doing many ritual. Mom's not much into Pali chanting, so she's not into bowing at all. So I kind of miss that aspect of the monastic life. I mean, I do it in my room and so on. just see the beauty of doing it, the same chant again and again and again. Not because it's entertaining or not because it's sort of fantastically informative, but just because it brings the mind to a sense of maybe aspiration, brings out a sense of community. That's lovely, isn't it? The chanting, we're really rolling, aren't we? It's really nice to hear. Brings forth a sense of our communal effort in this. It's lovely, isn't it? We're beautiful. I like bowing. We're taught to, in the monastery too, when we go to our hut to bow, when we leave our hut to bow, when we go to the shrine room to bow, when we go see our teacher to bow, when we leave our teacher to bow, do a lot of bowing. And maybe it's not efficient. Just plonk yourself down. But it is a beautiful reminder. It's not necessary, you know, it's not necessary. So it's cultural. But just like coming into a shrine room and then stopping and then looking at the Buddha Rupa and just remembering that the Buddha image and the iconography of Buddhism is to remind us of awake. That's what it's there for, just awake, awake. So when you see the, you know, when you come in the door and you see that Buddha image there, lovely one that Spijak made, he made both of these, a Polish friend, and you just remember what that is. It's the awake mind. So the imagery is not sort of superstition. It's not duality. It's not a praying to a external god. It's imagery which brings me home, hopefully. So like if you have an image at home and you use that, and when you see that image, oh yeah, presence. Be here now. Still here? Just that. And that over a lifetime, done again and again and again, is very powerful. Imagery can be very, very powerful. So this is what this shrine is about. The candles represent wisdom. The flowers represent morality. The incense, which I'm not burning because someone's allergic to it, represents concentration of mind. The Buddha image is both the reflection on devotion and a reflection on awakeness. So that's a kind of, it's a very simple thing to do, but in our culture, we really are not a stopping culture, are we? It seems to be the most difficult thing our culture finds, is stopping. This kind of driven nature of our culture, there always seems to be more to do, and we have to be more productive, and so our minds are conditioned towards very much towards becoming, I think. You know? There's a lot of that. You have to, I mean, just it seems to just to survive in the work world, you have to do multitask and get 101 things done. So when we come into this kind of environment, the ability just to stop is probably difficult because we have a whole different way of functioning. So in the last 2 days, we put the brakes on, and so that if you find that difficult, just being here, just being with something simple like the breath, with no emails and no people to talk to, and no distractions or whatever. Maybe that's very beautiful. There's a beautiful aspect to it. Just oh, great, that can stop. But many people find oh, I can stop, and then. But there's still a momentum of doing, of doing, of doing, of doing. And so part of our, you know, just the initial part of retreat, just the slowing down, slowing down, slowing down. Nothing special. Earthworm practice. So you need a lot of faith in that. You need a lot of faith. Just trust. Just trust the process. Just trust in the continual emphasis on awakening, awakening, awakening. For those of you who have done a lot of retreats, you sort of you know that kind of process. If you've never done a retreat before, sometimes the second day your mind isn't quite, become discouraged or whatever. But it's just the mind takes a while to slow down. Talking with David who drove us up on from Ottawa, he was saying that weekend retreat didn't find that you can really takes longer to slow the mind down. So imagine if we were doing a weekend retreat, be back home now, answering your emails. All those emails which got missed. So we're blessed, aren't we, that we can be here for a longer period of time to allow the mind to really settle. So I was going through that, the sort of foundation teaching or root teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And I do think it's in an age of eclectic religion, in an age where we do have access to so many interesting, good, and wholesome teachings, the danger is that we're like dilettantes, is that the word? Where we flit around from one, one thing to another. And then, as I was saying, the kind of depth of one particular paradigm or model, we don't get that. And we kind of jump around, we use a Sufi model, we use a Hindu model, a Buddhist model, a Christian mysticism model, and so on and so forth. And none of, they all have wisdom, I think, the mystical traditions, they all have their own wisdom. But I know I don't understand Christian mysticism because I haven't practiced it. I've read it, certainly read Eckhart and others, but who's the American? Merton? I really like that. I love the passion of his writing, but I couldn't figure out what he's talking about. I found it really, somehow I enjoyed that. So I've read that, but I haven't worked with those ideas, I haven't worked with those paradigms, so I can't really make comment about that. So there is a difference between being maybe inspired by something, some teaching or some reading, that, and then really working with something again and again and again, where it becomes the sort of, shall we say, the default mechanism. That's a good thing to consider. What is the default mechanism in your mind? Like when you're not practicing, what happens to your mind? Where does it go? Wholesome, unwholesome? Or when you have difficulties, what's the default mechanism? What clicks in? We say the practice clicks in. What clicks in for you? Is it mindfulness? Is it a trust in mindfulness? What happens? When we emphasize certain structures and practice, intellectual structures, moral structures, certain kind of contemplative, reflective practices again and again and again, they become the default structures. In a good way, and the way we talk about, we say that the practice clicks in. It just functions because one has been doing it so often and so repeatedly. And hopefully the Four Noble Truths then become the intellectual default structure in Theravada Buddhism, because then when there is some form of discontent, if we have that structure in place, then that discontent is ennobling. It ennobles our mind, because that discontent is saying there's something I don't understand. I'm suffering. I'm caught up with something. And because I don't understand that ignorance, and until I do understand that, that ignorance is going to plague me. It's going to haunt me. But if I take it on board and say, all right, so where's the problem? What is it? And that whole structure comes into play in my in the way I view things, in the way I investigate things, then it ennobles me, because it shows me the cause, it shows me where I'm attached, it shows me where the problem is, so it liberates the mind. That's the idea of taking a teaching, yeah? That's the idea of taking a contemplative or reflective approach to a teaching, rather than a doctrinal. The doctrinaire mind, is that right? Doctrinaire mind, the one that we kind of like pedantic doctrinaire mind, doesn't reflect, just takes a position and believes or disbelieves. It doesn't have freedom. So that's called belief Buddhism, which is fine, but reflective Buddhism certainly has those structures, but then makes them alive in the very living of our lives. They're not just kind of dead artifacts that we leave on the bookshelf. So I'm justifying teaching the Four Noble Truths again, for the others of you who heard it many times. But I found it very, very fruitful, very rewarding. I'm amazed how I still, you know, it still seems I keep learning from it. So there is the noble truth of suffering. There's the noble truth of the cause of suffering. There's the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. There's the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. There's the noble truth of suffering. This suffering must be understood. Right? There's the noble truth of the cause of suffering. The cause is attachment to craving. This craving must be abandoned. There's the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. This cessation must be realized. There's the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. This path must be developed. Right? Over and over again. Right? So this whole sense of suffering ennobling you is different. Like the consumer culture is, you don't have to be unhappy. You can get Botox and a Lexus and you will be happy, or whatever it is. So it's always just promoting some kind of up mind. So if suffering, you don't talk about suffering, you get away from it, you're annihilated, you're distracted. Whereas Buddhism, you go into it. Not in a kind of morbid way of self-mortification. It's not that, because we have enough suffering without having to sleep on beds of nails, do we? There's enough discontent. It doesn't have to be major stuff. So that's a maturity, I think. You know, this kind of maturity and consciousness which is willing to take responsibility for the mind and heart. And just this idea, this is suffering, it's not me, it's not a personal problem, just consciousness and suffering, gives one the objective perspective on this. The suffering we experience is personal, certainly. My pain, my sorrow, my anxiety, my anger, and all that is different than yours in a storyline sense, right? But it can be looked at objectively. So there is personal responsibility, sure, but also there's objective observation of the whole nature of our conscious experience. And that's what we're trying to do on this retreat. Again, we've simplified things, we've honed it down to where we can just watch how consciousness responds or reacts to all the different experiences we're having, both in the shrine room and outside the shrine room. The likes, the dislikes, the uncomfortableness, the memories that come up, the success, the failure, all this movement we can just observe and see as movement. Hopefully that's what we do. When we get caught up in personality, what we call personality view, then like let's say I practice for an hour of meditation and nothing goes. It's just all over the shop. I can't settle the mind down. The bell rings and then there's a sense, oh, I can't do this. I just can't do this. That's not awareness. That's attachment. Awareness is, oh, this is a feeling of failure. This is a feeling of hopelessness. And that's the entry point into Buddhist practice. The entry point is to not take it personally and yet take responsibility for it. It's there, but to kind of get a sense of distance on it, get a sense of objectivity. So we're moving away from the storylines, aren't we? Away from the storylines into the more visceral experience, into the very nature of the mood. So we talk about knowing the body in the body, knowing moods as moods, knowing feelings as feelings. This is the way we talk about it. The fourth noble truth is the noble truth of the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. So it's known as the Noble Eightfold Path, and it is, there's many translations for it, but it begins with right understanding, right thought, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Right. Right, not in a kind of doctrinal sense, there's only this Buddhist way, but right because it leads to one thing, it leads to liberation, leads to peace, leads to the end of suffering. And so the Buddhist take on our human predicament is that the problem is not some kind of primal sin or original sin in consciousness, it's simply not understanding. It's a mistake. Suffering's a kind of mistaken identity thing. We've just not seen clearly. And so when we do suffer, or when there is any discontent, then there's something we don't understand. There's something we take in the wrong way, and we need to understand. We need to see clearly. So the way we can understand life is to somehow sustain awakeness, sustain a perspective of observing or watching in a non-judgmental way. And hence the emphasis on right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is the awakened mind. It's very simple. It's not something you have to get later on. It's not like you practice it all during the sritan so that on day 9 you can get right mindfulness. Then you just keep remembering, oh, this is the way it is. And you've probably been beat up with that phrase so many times now. But it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to sustain this awake mind. The mind just kind of gets caught up with all kinds of things. So that's part of right effort. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Right effort is to remember the awakened mind. And to begin to make determinations or make statements to myself about those areas where I fall asleep, where I get caught up, where I get preoccupied with all kinds of obsessions, to make statements to myself. I'm going to try to awake to that, not get rid of it. So if I have a kind of planning mind, loves to plan all the time, just kind of goes off into planning this and that, and I finally realize that that's really probably not what I want to do the rest of my life. It's probably not liberation, and I suffer from it. Then I could just try to repress that. And we're not going to plan now. We're not going to plan, and I'll probably plan more. It's the way suppression works. You hold it all down. And you say, "Wow, I just built a monastery," and the bell rang. So suppression doesn't work. So the determination I try to make is to awaken in those areas where I know I just tend to get I fall asleep. Now that I can do. That's a suggestion that which is achievable, say, or possible. The suggestion that I won't do that is not, because our consciousness is habituated to function in certain ways, and that's what we're up against. We're up against these kind of addictive habits of obsessive thinking. So that's a skillful suggestion to make, and that is right thought. Yeah. So from understanding that the tendency of my consciousness is to get preoccupied with fantasizing or planning, I say, oh, I see, that's the mind keeps kind of just going off there. All right, so I'll think rightly. And how do I think rightly? I say, I'm going to try to notice when that arises, or when that ceases, or I'm going to try to notice that in the body, or whatever, right? So, but the suggestion is coming from understanding. It's not coming from self-hatred or all those kinds of things. And it's a suggestion simply to make awareness a more continual kind of experience. So that's what we're trying to get. We're trying to get continuity of attention, right? Now, if I can sustain awareness around, if I can see the arising of the planning mind, say, oh, there it is again. And I become more and more adept at that, then that object of the planning mind no longer obsesses me. And my awareness then becomes bigger than the planning mind. My awareness becomes bigger and more peaceful, because it's no longer addicted to, caught up by, preoccupied with the planning. Not because I've just repressed planning, because I know, I understand this is planning, it has arisen. Then if I want to use the planning mind, fine, that's fine. I'm not rejecting the analytical faculty, but now I have a choice. And that might be quite difficult. Very, very difficult. I have a friend that just sent me an email. He's been in the practice for as long as I, over 30 years. He's a very good, diligent meditator. He does a lot of building work, does a lot of charity, and likes building work. And he tells me this story where he's doing a self-retreat, just finished it, and he's got a farm track where he does his walking meditation on. And the track, he finds about 7 paces in the track, it's a very pothole track. He finds about 7 paces, and he just kind of walks in those 7 paces. He says, well, maybe if I fill one of those potholes. Uh-oh. So he says, it's on the way to my hut. He goes to his hut, and then he starts to carry gravel. Right? I'll just one bucket at a time, it's fine. It'll help the next guy. Fills in the first hole, right? So he extends his path now to 15 paces. 15 paces. Well, there's another hole there. So he goes and he starts, and he just like, his whole meditation becomes this obsession with his walking path, right? Just to, and he, well, actually, I could, it's only a kilometer down. I could probably, it'd be good for the next guy. Yeah, okay. Carrying the bucket. So one day he's meditating, and he's got very good absorption, actually. Very good meditating. Just absorbed. He hears some kind of noise in the back, and he's so absorbed in his object of meditation, he comes out of it. There's a bulldozer's come, right? And apparently, a farmer saw him carrying his buckets. Poor guy, I'll help him out. So he comes with this really rough tractor and just demolishes his path. He's got all these potholes. So it's, like a whole month. And he's hilarious the way he writes this. He's hilarious. Because that's what his mind likes to do. It likes to do good things for people. It likes to do building work. It likes to plan. That's known as rebirth. Now, there's nothing immoral about that. It's a very good thing, and I'm sure. But you can see how that's what his mind loves to do. It loves to engage in that way. Loves to do that. So that whole aspect of like taking some time and not engaging with the objects of consciousness is quite difficult. Not engaging with fantasies or whatever it is, that kind of aspect of renunciation. Because all of us have done that, where I think where we engage with some brilliant idea and then we can't let it go. This really, really good idea. For me, it was pop songs. Because I was bored, I'd do pop songs. And then I couldn't get rid of them. Get out of here, some Bob Dylan song or something, and because I was so bored, right? It was just so boring. It's like you'd have the meal at 8 o'clock, and that was it till the next day. That was it. There was no coffee, no tea, no books, no one to speak English with, and just this walking path and your cushion and water. So, they'd just be so bored, and then this thing would float into the mind, this old memory. Ah, Bob Dylan. And I'd just pick it up, and I'd sing it. I'd be so happy. That's great. Just rolling along. And then, okay, I'll stop that now. Nope. Then I'd just come back. Shut up, will you? So one learns renunciation, which is the kind of temptation to go for the pleasant. And that's not kind of suppressing things. It's just that what my friend said, what really helped him, was that reflection on danger. there is the in the sense world, there's the gratification from sense experience, but there's the danger. Right? There was the gratification from the Bob Dylan song, felt great, but then the danger was, of course, it obsessed the mind. And now that doesn't sound a big deal, but I think the choice has to finally be made somehow that the liberation of the heart is not a sense experience in the normal way we experience things. It's not a sight or a sound or an image or a thought or an emotion, because all of those are very, very transient, they're very fragile, they're dependent on causes and conditions, they're unsatisfactory. So part of what we call right understanding is that all sense experience is tainted. It's not bad, it's not immoral, but it cannot be where liberation lies, it cannot be where the deepest peace lies, it can't be, because it's always causally conditioned. Right? So the happiness I have is happiness, you know, the happiness of food or good music or whatever you like, but that it's just happiness, and happiness is not liberating. Which doesn't mean that liberation is depressing either, right? It's just that happiness is contingent, that's all. So without rejecting happiness, happiness can be very helpful. I can feel uplifted, so a sunny day can really lift me out of the gloom of a November day, say, that's fine, I like that. Go take a trip to Mexico and you know, if it works out well, enjoy yourself or whatever. But the spiritual life is deeper than happiness and unhappiness. There's something more profound, and that profundity is realized through the sustaining of awareness through all conditions. So in this retreat, what I'm suggesting is that try to use all the conditions that you experience as a way of deepening your awareness. Right? So I have a meditation which I judge as being no good, let's say, because I have some idea of what good is. And then if I'm really aware, I really just use that. A very judgment. I'm not getting anywhere. This is the way it is now. It feels this way. Right? So, and that takes me to the next moment, and the next moment. And that's the training in right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, because concentration is the ability to sustain awareness for longer periods of time. Longer periods of time. And the teachings on right mindfulness also encourage the cultivation of in the text, it's called it, often right mindfulness is also kind of right recollection. You recollect things. So when I say to you, how is it now? I'm not asking for you to define it in some intellectual sense. I'm just saying, wake up, right? And you don't have to have an answer to it. Right? So you're recollecting the present moment. You're remembering this is the way it is now, not as an idea, but as a felt experience. So we can also recollect things like the Dharma. We can recollect that that which has a nature to begin has a nature to end. So if I have a meditation which is really very, very blissful, the recollection is, this is what bliss feels like, and it's unsatisfactory. But we usually don't do that, do we? We say, this is what bliss feels like, and I've got it! Finally! And then, of course, in the next 2 years, recollect that bliss. So it takes a lot of skill to let go of bliss, isn't it? You have to be burned a lot with bliss to let go of bliss. So bliss is great, because it can really relax the heart and uplift the mind and encourage you and all the rest of it. But the knowing of bliss and the knowing of non-bliss is deeper. There's something more profound. It's a kind of Well, it hasn't got the usual quality of up and down to it. The feeling of wanting to leave, say. So if the usually teachers say, well, by day four you'll be fine. You hit day five, you're still crashing, nothing's working, and well, it's not gonna work for me, I'm out of here. The very feeling of, I'm out of here, I can't do this, will change. Now, if you look at that feeling as a feeling, it will change. But if you believe in the feeling, I can't do meditation, I can't do meditation, I can't do meditation, then you can't do meditation because you've been reborn and a can't do meditator. But if you just see that feeling, well, I can't meditate, and you know that's a feeling of being, you know, I can't do it, then you're meditating. That's all. And if you don't believe in it, then you're mindful again. You're just that way. So you can recollect the Dharma. That which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. And some things it's very difficult to meditate on. So those aspects of your psyche which are very unskillful, like the kind of very judgmental, or like if your mind is very self-critical, self-judgmental, very demanding, all those kinds of things, to see that as an object of mind. So that's just a perception, that's all. That's just a perception, just a soap bubble. It's liberation from perceptions. You see someone in a dining room who is not mindful. You know, the critical mind sitting there, may all beings be well, that one's not mindful. That's habit, isn't it? That's just habit. And it creates a perception, slob. And then you just, oh, that's just a perception. That has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease. You're liberated from perception. It's wonderful. Perception of yourself, perception of others. Yeah? Wonderful, wonderful. Freedom, freedom. Well, you're not denying perceptions. You're not denying the critical mind. So you're not, you know, you start and the fire starts. Well, that's just a fire perception. You're not being stupid. But you're seeing perception as perception, just that way. Yeah? It's all the self-perceptions we have. I'm this, I'm that, I'm successful, I'm unsuccessful. It's just soap bubbles coming and going, coming and going. And that which knows, that's what we're training in. The change of perceptions. Retreat's going well, retreat's not going well, last year it was better, this year it's better, you know, all that comparison. Or you see someone else who can kind of sit for 2 hours without budging. Oh, must be enlightened. Must be like me. I move every 5 minutes. Oh, I'm hopeless. Comparison is a perception. It comes and it goes. So you're going to see how the whole sense of I and self is simply a perception. It comes and it goes. It comes and it goes, according to different moods. If you're if you had a good meditation, your perception is that you're a good meditator. If you had a bad meditation, you're a bad meditator. Just a perception. So awareness begins to, so you keep recollecting Dharma. So part of mindfulness is recollecting Dharma. You can recollect wholesome states of mind. So just like anapanasati. Anapanasati is mindfulness. Anapana is in and out. We're recollecting in and out breath. Anapanasati. That's what it's called. So we're recollecting a bodily function, in and out. Recollecting metta or karuna or mudita or upekkha, recollecting the open heart. So that's a skillful thing to do. So you know, I suggest bring up an image of someone you love, someone you care for, and then recollect that feeling of care or gratitude. Say gratitude. Do that. Gratitude is a really neat one to do. Got nothing to do, do gratitude. So you just recollect. Some kindness that has been done to you, or some goodness that has come to you, and just recollect that. Oh. And bring the heart to a sense of gratitude. That's part of right mindfulness, the recollection of the wholesome, also part of right effort. And we can do that. So we have a capacity to bring up skillful perceptions, to bring up skillful energy, skillful states of mind. But it's never from becoming. And this is the hard part. Because we're so, all our conditioning, my conditioning when I started and still, is to this strong sense of achievement and becoming and getting rid of and all that. So to make effort around recollecting, say, just metta, the sense of loving kindness in the heart, without trying to manufacture loving kindness. Quite often we get into that, well, you've got to get the heart open and pumping and be one with all beings and all that kind of stuff, which is just greed, greed for some kind of stuff one's read about or heard about or felt even, right? But that's becoming, whereas it just recollecting, may all beings be free from suffering. Just that, that's just recollecting that thought. But the greed mind gets so perverse, doesn't it? So that's why I've been trying to really emphasize this whole sense of non-becoming, non-attainment, non-aversion. If one paints the whole enlightenment trip in a very positive way, that is peaceful, it's non-dual, it's loving, unification of consciousness, or whatever way to talk about it, then we want that. As soon as if I say to you, a liberation is just kind of this extremely loving, open, wise way of being, then you start to try to find that, this extreme, and I suppress the other, this kind of mean-hearted little guy in here, who's really not complaining a bit, or whatever in there. And I get into greed, and I get into trying to become. So I really like the Four Noble Truths, because it's talking about letting go, not becoming. So letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. So any kind of practices which are kind of proactive in that way of bringing up loving kindness, they're very important. I do them a lot. But they're not from trying to get something. Trying to get some state of mind. They're simply tapping into something we have already known, or that we already know. All of us know some sense of openness to life. All of us know some sense of appreciation to life. All of us know some sense of compassion. We have that. So those practices are simply recollecting the way of the open heart, not trying to manufacture something. And I'll talk about those things. So right effort to recollect the wholesome, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, they're really a package to recollect the wholesome and to know the unwholesome and not buy into it, not believe in it. And that's what we're working a lot with on a retreat. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, trying to get those. Concentration is oftentimes painted in very, very high terms, jhanas and absorptions and so on and so forth. But it's also painted in very, very ordinary ways of just not getting caught up in the anger, not getting caught up in the fear, not getting caught up in the storyline, just knowing, well, that's just a storyline, that's just anger, not getting caught up in the dullness, not getting caught up in the restlessness, it's just dullness, and learning about that in very, very simple ways. So maybe with right concentration, just see it for now, it's just sustaining awareness. Sustaining the awake mind for one in-breath, staying connected with one in-breath, rather than the achievement mind. Because in Theravada Buddhism you get a lot of teachings about very high meditative states, and people get very, very greedy for those. And then they attain them, and then they get very conceited about them. So you hear people, oh, have you got the first one? Oh, I got the second one. And you look at it and say, is that what it's about? So certainly there are states of meditative absorption, but let those happen by themselves. Don't worry about it. Just kind of my suggestion to you. You'll hear other suggestions. But if you keep it more humble, just more humble, I'll just be with with one footstep, or I'll just be with the soup. You just be mindful with the soup. Now, mindful with the soup doesn't mean that you have to then have this horrible meal Wouldn't it be awful to live that way? Mindfulness isn't control. Mindfulness is this lovely open way of knowing the way things are. So you eat your soup. And then you see thoughts coming and going, and you hear your kind of mind criticizing this guy that's slurping the soup beside you. Whatever's going on, it's just that. That's just what's happening. So it's a lovely kind of experience, being present to the way things are, rather than mindfulness is just, if you think mindfulness is just kind of controlling things all the time, you get so uptight, and you hate it after a while. It's not being out of control either. That's not it. But see, like if you're walking on the meditation path, you're just trying to control every step, you might do it for 10, 20, 30 minutes, then you take the control off and your mind goes bananas. It's all the same old rubbish comes up, isn't it? Whereas a more open attitude, okay, the body feels this way, okay, these thoughts are coming up, I know them, they're coming and they're going. You begin to just have this lovely coolness to the arising and passing away of thoughts and emotions, and it's not just kind of controlling things, trying to get rid of them. And that you can sustain, you know, that has a lovely open quality, a lovely pleasant quality to it. So the suggestions then is like, how can I wake up in those areas where I tend to lose it? So just to close, may I make the suggestion that when you hear the bell tomorrow morning, or if you wake up before the bell, first thing, what's the mood of the mind? Do you really wake up? What is it? What's going on? What's the thought pattern? It might be left over from the dream realm. It might be just this kind of grumpy state, sort of not wanting quite to be here. It might be, oh great, I can meditate. Whatever it is, it's really wake up. This is the way it is now. And then another moment, then another moment. You keep making those moments continuous. Then you have right mindfulness. Everything should take care of itself from there. If you know, the insights and the understanding will take care of itself. If you just sustain that. So we were just, Venerable Pavaro read a nice bit from Ajahn Liam's biography, and he asks himself the question, why do we do this practice? Why do we do this practice? We do the practice for the sake of doing the practice. We do awakeness for the sake of being awake. And the rest we just trust him. So non-becoming, right? Just awake. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection tonight.